Guardian Unlimited.
Anthony Gormley needs no introduction from me. The papers are full of him. He's just opened a huge exhibition at the Hayward Gallery, and his casts are dotting the London skyline, as they have done beaches in the northwest and the northeast. Penny Woolcock is a filmmaker who's made a number of films in very, very political territory. The Death of Klinghoffer, for example, touched on Palestinian-Israeli issues. And most recently, she's been working in Margate on a film project called Exodus. Matthew Taylor, on my left, has just emerged from Downing Street, a much happier man to be out, I gather, and is now... running the Royal Society of Arts. He says he's a Philistine. That's what he said when he arrived this evening.
It hasn't changed yet.
But I'm sure the Royal Society of Arts will hope it changes very soon. And Rashnara Ali has just been selected as a parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party in Bethnal Green. So she's putting herself right in the middle of a very tough political battle, but she brings to it several different types of experience of government and politics. She's been in the Home Office and she's been deputy director at the Young Foundation, which is all about social engagement, social entrepreneurship. I asked her for a quick strap line as to what the Young Foundation was. Needless to say, she doesn't have one, I don't have one. But then soundbite politics is precise.
Isn't it the organisational reflection of Jeff Morgan's brain?
I'm not sure that counts as a quick strap line, but yeah. So I'm going to ask first Anthony to speak for a few minutes to try and help us kind of think through politics versus the arts. Who has the real power?
Right. Rohanna's been trying to get 500 words out of me for the last week, and I think she got about 10. But taking a cue from Madeline at the end of her article that was published this morning, she asks rhetorically whether art has never had so much political expectation thrust on it. I would put towards you this evening that art is intrinsically political. It is about one person's, in a way, expression of and use of their own freedom to act. I think it is inherently optimistic because it makes a statement that actually one person can change the world, even if that world only exists on a small bit of paper 5 inches by 7. But there is a sense in which that act, as an act of shared communication, in a small way, is saying, I make the world, not simply inhabit it. And I think that there is a sense in which politics is rather jealous of that ability to act. I think that we are living in an extraordinary time where Britain, having in a sense always been a kind of voyeur of artistic innovation elsewhere, has become, in a way, an agenda setter for the world. And I think it's an extraordinary time because, in a sense, we've always been very suspicious of art's power to change things. But now it is actually for us right here now. In answer to Rohanna's request, I just made 4 propositions which I'd like to read out to you now, and then I'm going to hand over to Penny. The first proposition is that politics has become management. The second is that ideological positions are untenable when comfort is the highest good. The third proposition is that we are post-ideologic. And the fourth is that art perhaps can offer an arena for the creation of new value.
Well, some random initial thoughts. When I was at IPPR, I was known as more tank than think, and I guess I'm now more society than arts. What I'll do in my few minutes, I think, is talk about the RSA's view of the world and then how it seems to me the role art can play in relation to our view of the world, but then the problem that I've got with one particular aspect of that, or the question I've got with one particular aspect of that. So the RSA's view of the world is that one of the ways of thinking about the challenges of the future is that there is a broad progressive consensus in Britain. We're not a divided country in the same way as America or Iran or possibly Russia in terms of the kind of place we want to live in. I'd say that's part of the sort of unsung Blair legacy. But the problem is not so much that we don't agree, roughly speaking, about the kind of place we want to live in. The problem is that we don't behave, we don't think in the ways in which we need to think and behave to make that future possible. And we think at the RSA that, therefore, one of the ways of viewing the future is to say, the question is, how do we enable citizens to be the people they need to be if they're going to create the kind of society that they say they want to live in? And we think this can be broken down into three different challenges. One is, how can you encourage people to be more engaged democratic participants at the global, the national, and the local level? So how do you get people out of a sort of passive-aggressive stance, readily encouraged for them by the media towards decision-making, and instead get them, on the one hand, to give a license to politicians to show courage and bravery, and on the other hand, to recognise the role they have themselves in meeting many of our challenges. The second thing that we need from citizens of tomorrow is that they need to be more self-sufficient for a whole variety of factors, which I won't go into now, to do with globalisation, technological change, population ageing, rising expectations. If people are not able better to look after themselves, to look after their health, to invest in their learning, to recognise the need to provide for themselves when they retire, to limit their carbon footprint, then we have a sort of problem of unsustainability and also a problem about success in the modern world and economy. And then thirdly, citizens need to be other regarding, by which I mean they need to get on with strangers in public, the kind of agenda that David Cameron's been talking about, although he hasn't yet developed any answers, to care for family, friends, neighbours, and the more formal types of volunteering and giving back to society. So that's the people we need to be if we're going to live in the kind of society we want to live in. Now, what is the role that art has to play in that? Now, in two of these areas, I even though I am a Philistine, can see and feel a strong role for art, a strong power. Firstly, looking at it in reverse order, in terms of other regarding, I think that art can be incredibly powerful in encouraging connectivity, empathy, solidarity. And so in terms of getting us to think about other people and our relationships to other people, I think art can be incredibly powerful, and possibly more powerful than politics, actually, in that regard, at its best. I think in relation to this notion of self-sufficiency, art is also incredibly important, because I think that in getting us to manage ourselves, to feel empowered, to tap into our own creativity, I think art is very important. For example, I would give art a much, much stronger role in the curriculum that's taught in schools, because as someone who was talking to me the other day about computer programming, and they thought it was rather quaint, the government's approach, and I don't criticise the government for this, is I guess the only way you can go about it if you are a government, which is, you know, we need more people to work in computing, so we should teach more people computer skills. And I said to him, will that work? He said, no, the best advice I could give to somebody who wants to be a computer expert in 10 years' time is to learn poetry, because probably the thought processes you go through to read and to understand poetry are going to be the most important. It won't be to do with keyboards or mice, or any of those things. It'll be to do with those sorts of powers of creativity. So that's fine. Now, I end then with my first point, which is about this notion of democratic engagement. And that's where I guess I have an issue for us to discuss. And in the brief words that I wrote on the website, C.P. Snow had this notion, didn't he, 50 years ago, about the two cultures of science and art. And it's interesting in the climate change space that scientists and artists are working well together. And we want to work in this space. We're proud to be working with Arts Council England on a project around arts and ecology, which we're going to be launching in a few weeks' time. And that's going to be looking at providing a sort of global hub for artists working in the space of ecology and environment. And implicit in that is the idea there is now some moral necessity for artists to focus on this issue. But even talking to people in the RSA, they worry at my sort of political sense that people should be organised and that there should be some sort of manifesto and statement and artists should be pressurised to do something about this issue, because it's infringe upon artistic freedom. And so my thought was that possibly artists and scientists can speak to each other for the reasons that you were intimating, actually, which is that great scientists and great artists are powerfully committed to the notion of the role of the individual, in the heroic individual in making change happen, driven by pure ideals. And maybe the contrast is not between science and art, but it's between science and art and the spaces they can work in on the one hand and politics on the other. And the point that I made in my brief comments is that, is there a sort of mirror here, which is that what artists are accused of, often by the popular media and by people themselves sometimes, is an unwillingness to compromise with the public. So sometimes the obscurity of contemporary art feels like an unwillingness to compromise with the understandings of less cultured people. Whereas, of course, politicians are constantly attacked for the reverse. Their never-ending willingness to compromise with the limited imaginations of ordinary citizens in Middle England. And I think that, therefore, there is something here which does excite me. And I turn to one of my favourite recent short books, which is a book called The Future of American Progressivism, written by Cornel West and Roberto Unger. It's about how do you reconcile vision and idealism with practical change. And for them, one of the great dividing lines in progressive thought is this dividing line between the visionaries and idealists on the one hand and the practical policymakers on the other. And they have this quote, which I shall end with. It's easy to be a realist when you accept everything. It's easy to be a visionary when you confront nothing. To accept little and confront much and to do so on the basis of piecemeal but cumulative change is the way and the solution. I tend to agree with that.
Penny.
Well, I was interested in talking about art as an agency for change and for telling the truth, which neither of those things I think politics is any good at all at the moment. But I don't think art is actually has any power to do these things at all. I mean, when you look at, say, Northern Ireland, there were plenty of Radio 4 plays and all kinds of things about, you know, commenting on the Troubles. And actually, in the end, it was people got fed up with being these very large bombs in Manchester and London, and a very large amount of money was ploughed in to solve the problem. So I think killing large numbers of people and large sums of money is what really makes change. But art, of course, can contribute, actually. And unless we live in a society where art is doing that and is trying to tell the truth about, for example, the kind of bloody chaos at the moment in Iraq, then I think we're in a society in very real trouble. Because what else do we do? I mean, 2 million of us, and probably many of the people, obviously not everyone, in this room went out to try and prevent the war happening. We were taken absolutely no notice of whatsoever, and then we all just went home and went shopping, because unless you're prepared to go and blow people up on buses, what do you do? And so it's not to say that art can do nothing about this, because I think it actually can. That, say, with the Vietnam War, and I am obsessed with the war, but I do think that it is the thing that we ought to be obsessed with at the moment. There were two photographs, and one of them, the photograph of the Viet Cong man being executed, which is like Manet's execution of the Emperor Maximilian. It's an absolutely fantastically beautifully framed photograph that really seared into people's mind. And the other one was the photograph of that little girl whose clothes had been burnt off for coming up the street. And I can see everybody remembering those pictures. And those pictures probably did as much to sort of symbolise the deaths of innocent people being caught up in this ridiculous, horrible adventure as anything else, really, the news or any kind of politics. And I think that that what art can do is somehow capture these moments and make something of them. I feel that we're in a good place here. In the last couple of weeks, I saw two plays. One was The Black Watch and the other's Fallujah, which is on at the Truman Brewery at the moment, which I encourage people to go and see, which are commenting on this bloody chaos which we are responsible for in an unmediated way. And that's a great relief, and you could feel that in the audience, that when people were applauding, it was just the relief of hearing somebody tell the truth in a way that wasn't mediated by any kind of other waffle. Although art can't change things, I think we have a responsibility, of course, to comment on the world that we're in, and that can be very powerful, and that we must do it.
Thank you. Rashnara.
Hello, thank you very much. I feel quite self-conscious given such a distinguished panel. I'm just going to pick on a couple of points. The first one is what Matthew said about the visionaries and idealists versus the practical change makers. And what I'm interested in is how you can be both, and perhaps it's too unrealistic a goal, but that's what I'm motivated by and inspired by, which is how you can retain a sense of idealism, which can be drawn from the arts and culture and wider experiences of life in society, and keep that in politics and be inspired by that and influenced by that and try always to focus on motivating others in that way. And those two things can often be compromised, whether you're in the arts or in politics. The second thing I'm particularly interested in is the issue of what do we mean by the arts? For me, it's in the broadest sense, particularly when I'm thinking politically. For me, it's about literature, it's about the visual arts, it's about satire, it's about music, it's about the whole lot, it's about film. And the more we think in the broader terms, the more it becomes relevant and useful and vital to political life. And if we take it from that perspective, then we can apply it very clearly to issues around political disengagement and the role that the arts can play in helping us to find solutions. And so then, you know, the series of issues that I'm particularly concerned about that came to mind when this discussion was brought up by Madeline was the issue of how the arts can play a role in capturing the public's imagination in trying to re-engage people in politics, and particularly young people. Increasingly, we're in competition in trying to attract their attention and interest when people have so many other facets, much more exciting in their view, much more exciting areas to get involved in, that in the context of new technology, new forms of networks, new forms of expression. So the politics is increasingly under huge pressure to raise its game, and I think that's really important, and I think that's really powerful, and the arts plays a very important role in acting as a check on keeping politicians and political parties on their toes.
There's a wide range of opinion here. I wonder whether perhaps the panel might want to take each other up on a couple of points before we open it to the audience. Anthony, I wondered, Matthew talked about moral necessity and that the artist has a sort of moral duty. Is that right, Matthew?
I think there's a question about whether or not you can make that argument without sounding like you're sort of stamping all over creativity. But what's interesting about climate change is whether that there's something different about climate change in terms of its order of magnitude and in terms of artists' relationships with the material world, which mark it out as being different from other political imperatives. I don't know. I've got an open mind on the issue.
No, I remember Jonathan Freeman asking at the end of that dinner at Hay on Wye, just said, where is the Guernica of global warming? And it's almost like that question, well, like your two photographs from Vietnam as the kind of the searing conscience, that those are the images that in some way we could not afford to ignore. And I mean the real issue here for me is that we are all, as it were, subject to that looming conscience, and yet we can't have a state invited competition to find the equivalent image. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen through policy. It's going to happen, I think, spontaneously and without any of us quite knowing what it's going to be. But I think at the background of all of this is that sense that somehow the art has to be put to work in terms of making equivalent images for our sense of urgency on this subject. And I think for me there are alarm bells ringing about that instrumentalist use of art, which should be an open space.
When you say alarm bells, in the conversation that we had last week, I thought you talked about the kind of liberating the viewer in the way that art had managed to liberate itself. I wondered if you could just...
Yeah, no, I think this is very... I mean, for me, this is very, very important. It seems to me that the history of the 20th century was, in terms of the development, the heroic story of modernism was of art, in a way, managing to liberate itself from the duties of the representation of foundational myths, whether those are historic, political, or religious, and investigate, as it were, the syntax of its own formal language. And I think that all of us
working today as artists are beneficiaries of that heroic story. However, you know, the shadow side of that is that, you know, the works of Mondrian and Kandinsky in some way have become icons of that particular, in a way, investigation, and have ceased to become, as it were, public goods in the way in which, in the high kind of manifestos of early modernism, you know, Mondrian's language was seen as a liberation of the language of art that would be able to touch and speak to anyone, irrespective of race, creed, language. And my feeling now is that, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so determined, in a way, to make work in collective space, is that I want to offer back to the viewer that, in a way, freedom that art gained for itself in the 20th century. I want to, in a way, allow art to be a place where, in a sense, an act of creation takes place as a collaborative act, where meaning is not defined, as it were, through a symbolic language that is shared, which is the thing that Peter Fuller used to lament the loss of, that a symbolic language arises, or anyway, meaning or value arises by there being, as it were, a coming together. An artist might propose something, but in some way the work is completed by being accepted and, in a sense, imaginatively ingested by the viewer. And I would like to sort of say that some of the... I think of all of my projects in some ways, in a way, propositions or experiments in this way. So The Angel of the North, in a sense, is an asking the question, is it possible in a time of doubt to make a transitional object that in some way talks about this time of change from the certainties of the industrial age to the uncertainties of the communication age? Is it possible, by placing these witnesses, these silent witnesses, facing out to the horizon, to talk about, in a way, who belongs and who doesn't belong, and whether human beings actually have a place within the elemental world, or whether we are toxic to it? I mean, very, very open questions, and how I think that they are the opposite of a picture. You go to Crosby Beach, and in some way you realize that you are part of a infection of that beach, of a just a slight acupuncture of that natural place, in which you are invited to participate in a contemplative act. And I see, you know, this is in a way my questioning of Matthew's position, because I think that in some way the best that art can offer is a place in which, through the, in a way, conditions of silence, stillness, and a sense of concentration, it's the viewer is in some way put into the position of being the maker of the world, and that is, it seems to me, that the best you can hope, and that is about as far away from propaganda as you can get.
I think what's interesting is that, as best as I can understand exactly what you're saying, actually, I mean, I think that there's the interesting challenge here is about politics. Good politics challenges people, and there is a distance between the politician and the audience, in the sense that if the politician is merely pandering, there is a problem. But if the politician is speaking a secret language and not really seeking to engage the citizen in an understanding of the issue, that too is... excludes. And in what you're describing a process in which the art is sufficiently accessible for people to relate to it, but at the same time challenges them to come towards it and be changed through it. Now that's what good politics is to me as well. It is possible. I mean, your work shows that it's possible. I guess that for too many people it can feel that art, on the one hand, doesn't really attract, it doesn't really, too much art does not really feel as though it invites people in to engage. And on the other hand, that it can sometimes have an attitude to politics, which is to encourage a higher version of the media's attempt to lull people into a sort of perpetual state of self-righteous rage. And that's where I get, you know, troubled by this.
Anybody in the audience wants to come in? There was somebody in the front here, and then there's a lady a bit two-thirds of the way back.
Right, Alan Marcus. In your article today, in fact, in The Guardian, you say that that today in politics there's no room for risk. And I think that's quite an interesting political statement because, of course, in arts, one assumes that good art is all about taking risks. And I wonder if the panel might like to comment on what they see as the role for risk taking in the interplay between politics and art.
What you mean, the risk of coming to a discussion like this where you sort of interact, politicians and artists try and talk to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. I think we'll take one or two questions just so the panel has a chance to think about things a bit.
Jane Bonham Carter, I'm a television producer and politician. And I'm interested, you were talking about the fact that climate change has not, the artists have not yet achieved their Guernica or whatever. Now, what's your attitude to Al Gore, who was one of the most uninteresting and boring politicians, and has used film to make an extremely important statement about climate change? So art and politics have come together in a rather positive way, it seems to me there.
Was it art? I don't know. I've never seen graphs dynamically. But I'm not sure that it quite makes it as an art piece.
Actually, Cornelia Parker's work is entirely, she's completely obsessed with climate change, and that's what her work is about. And I think sometimes these things take a while, actually. It's not like something sort of drifts in and everybody's instantly going to respond to it. I think there have been works, and actually your work in Antarctica was the same kind of thing, wasn't it? So I think that there is beginning to be an accumulation of very interesting work about climate change, actually.
Do you think you ought to do something? Ought to do something about climate change, Penny?
No, I don't think I ought to do anything, really. I think you can only do the things that you're moved to do and that feel vital and important to you. And
But ought is about a moral responsibility, which you do feel, you do have. You talked about it in your comments. You talked about a sense of moral.
Yes, but I don't think there's some kind of list that you make in terms of moral imperatives. Now you must do something about climate change. Now you must do something about whatever. I don't think it works like that. You know, there are things that are around in the ether almost, you know, that are important. And at a time like this, when actually art does feel very engaged with the world and people are much more interested in it than they have been for a long time, I think people have their fingers on the pulse in different ways and engage with it. But I don't think that you can sort of be that prescriptive about it. Although there's nothing wrong with patronage. I mean, patronage has produced a great deal of very good public art, you know, from the Sistine Chapel on, really. So I just don't think that there are rules or that you have to say, well, now you must make something about this. It doesn't, I don't think that makes good work. I think that makes kind of ploddy nonsense, really.
I'm going to make a couple of deliberately prosaic points in order to avoid allegations of obscurity. The first is that art can't exempt itself from climate change because art is implicated in climate change. People travel to, you know, the Edinburgh Festival, you know, it will be a far from carbon neutral event, to, you know, whatever its attempts to be right on, for example, because people travel all over the world to it. And in fact, you know, it's one of the main reasons people travel is to see and participate in art. So I think that you can argue that there is some sort of moral imperative, actually. And I think that is an argument that has to come from within. I think it's probably an argument that's much better coming from within the artistic community than coming from, you know, Philistines like me. But I think it's one of the debates we hope we'll provoke with this arts and ecology project. In relation to risk, well, as I tried to say earlier, I think good politicians do take risks. They do sometimes say things which go beyond where the public opinion is to see if they can pull public opinion to a different place. So on that level, But on the other hand, you know, artists don't run schools and hospitals, or, you know, they don't manage the police. So, you know, artists' risks are less consequential in that sense than politicians' risks, I guess.
But the process, the political process, has become very sort of minutely managed to reduce all kinds of risks. I mean, for example, you know, politicians all have to sound, you know, like they agree with each other if they're in a cabinet or a political party. They're not allowed to disagree.
I think that's changing. I mean, I think that was a particular type of politics which came out of a particular experience. I think it is starting to change. I think the public are saying that they actually want to hear different voices. I think, you know, what's interesting about Cameron is that although he hasn't yet come up with any solutions, and who knows whether he will, what he seems to have realised, and it is the luxury of not being in office, is that people don't want politicians just to talk about government. They want politicians to talk about society.
Two people at the back that wanted to come in.
Jonathan Rutherford. I really have liked what the two artists have said about art, and I find the whole discussion around politics incredibly depressing, because it's all Anthony Gormley says something about politics is about management now. Nobody's taken them up on that. And if I think about that image, Anthony, that you had of engaging with a piece of art and the stillness or whatever and feeling that you were kind of making it yourself, if we translate that into politics and the political, we have to go back to a kind of tradition of political struggle against things like injustice, when people's consciousness was changed. They actually felt that they could transform the world around them. Now, that has completely gone from our society. It's just not present at the moment. And I think the role of art is about reviving culture, bringing culture back to life, and through that, finding a language where we can start talking the political again. And I mean, who knows where it's going to come up? And it's not about this politicians changing their language and how are they going to talk down to people? How are we going to get people involved and to participate? It's going to have to come in ways that actually we maybe can't imagine at the moment. But that's a kind of form of hope. And I feel that, you know, that's something that's missing as well. And maybe that's something important for art to think about, is how it can sort of revive a sort of hopefulness, really.
I grew up, I mean, in the late 60s, I went off to university. And I think it's extraordinary if you think about that time, where on one level there was this huge surge of you know, political conscience in terms of the Vietnam War. And yet at the same time, what was happening in New York and in London was a curiously, you know, depoliticized work. I mean, you know, if you think about Bruce Connor, or you think about even early Hockney, I mean, there's just a sort of, you know, I mean, celebration of life itself that was consciously apolitical. And I think, you know, it's a very strange thing when I hear you talk like that. I think that there's a sense in which we are all complicit. I mean, when I said politics has become management, I think there is a. And then my second proposition, which was that it's very difficult to have, as it were, strong ideological positions when we all know that we are subject to the. Well, it's almost like a Punch and Judy show. It's a marionette show of national politics when we know that actually, you know, the real power is in the hands of multinational money managers who have absolutely no political responsibility. And so we're all complicit in a system that we know is, in a way, defunct. I think that those high ideological battles that were fought, I guess, in the early days of socialism, or the, you know, when I think about people going off to fight in the Spanish Civil War, the issues there were so clear, and it was possible to be ideologically active. And it's such a weird thing that shopping, or the world of I don't know, the exchange of commodity, has so impinged on people's ability to feel they can act and act, as it were, morally and clearly.
I just, you know,
This is, before you respond, there was just a couple of other people. Somebody said rubbish, so they're going to come in. It sort of follows a theme of waste. Neil, I think, was also wanting to come in.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Neil Lawson from the from Compass. I mean, I've been reading a lot about, forcing myself to read a lot about consumerism. And I came across a quote in a book called The Soul of the New Consumer, which is one of these brilliant management business school texts which aren't ashamed about, you know, selling everything to everyone and whatever. There was a quote from the journalist Brian Appleyard, who looked at a film in 1958 about the sinking of the Titanic called, the film was called A Night to Remember. And essentially, when the ship went down, it was a film about public safety. And then he switched forward to 1997 and the James Cameron film about the Titanic, which is essentially a film about a romance, about a private affair. And he said, in those intervening, you know, whatever they are, 20 years, he said the notion of the public realm died. And I think, you know, probably there or thereabouts, Brian Appleyard's probably just about right. And I think from the points that Anthony made, you know, the point about politics becoming management, I think is largely right. I think the notion of ideology versus, you call it comfort, I'm beginning to look at consumerism like as a notion of compensation for real life, real freedom. You know, like any compensation, it gives you something, but it doesn't give you the real thing. And then you said that we live in a post-ideological era. I actually disagree with that. I think we do live in an ideological era. We do live in a utopia. It's just not my utopia, it's someone else's utopia.
We all submit to that.
Well, we submit in a kind of, you know, we submit willingly, we submit knowingly, we submit with our compensation, of which I think some of your work begins to kind of open our minds to and takes us out of. And I think this, just to finish, I think this notion of, you know, the relationship between, you know, art and politics, at one level it doesn't work, and we see a bit of that tonight. At another level, I think about a council in the north of England, a very white working class council, one that's essentially kind of cloth cap and whippet bound, who commissioned someone to put up a statue because they knew that they had to do something to change the confidence and the culture and the notions of hope and standing of the people in their community. And that was a Labour council. It was in Gateshead, and the art and the statue they commissioned was the Angel of the North. And I think there is a place, some people in politics do know that stuff's important, and I think we need to try and encourage those people and get more of them to do it.
No, well, this actually answers Judith's point. It was absolutely extraordinary, the level of absolute political support for that proposition.
There's a guy who said rubbish. Do you want to expand on rubbish?
Sorry, my name's John Jordan. I agreed with most of what Jonathan said. I mean, when he said, you know, there weren't people engaged in struggles. I mean, I'm an artist, and I've tried most of my life to merge art and activism in social movements. And for me, my definition of both politics and art that has come through today is completely different. I don't think politicians change the world, and I don't think artists change the world, and I don't think experts change the world. Social movements change the world, and I think artists need to take the risk to move out of the world of representation, of telling us how bad the world is, and move into the world of transformation, of actually engaging themselves and in social movements and applying that creativity to social movements, because social movements desperately need creativity. They're grey, they're boring, they become as boring as politicians and as grey as politicians if artists don't get involved. And the history of the 20th century, the history of the 19th century, is rammed packed with artists doing that. Sylvia Pankhurst, you know, left the Royal College of Art to become involved in the suffragette movement. If artists want to change the world, they can. They have to take the risk of engaging in social movements, getting away from the world of commodification, leaving the art world, which is basically just a shadow of capitalism and the corporate world, and doing the real stuff, because we're in a crisis right now. And if they don't do that, I think we're all toast, and we all know it.
Matthew's been mumbling about cobblers. I don't think actually that was a reference to you, John.
I'm reminded of... there's an interesting contrast. I'm reminded of some work that the political scientist Stephen Coleman did. He did work on what he called BBs and PJs. BBs were people who watched Big Brother, and PJs were political junkies. And what he found was that BBs, ordinary people, ordinary TV viewers, they weren't political junkies, but they really respected political junkies. And they, if you were at a table of people watching Big, you know, Big Brother watchers, and they were discussing Jade or whatever, then a political person sat down, they would sort of defer to them, although they wouldn't really understand their world. Whereas when a table of political junkies sat down, if someone from Big Brother land came and sat down and talked about Big Brother, they just treat this person with utter contempt, as if they had sort of, you know, some sort of psychological disorder. And of course, no, but you lot are just the same about politics. You are, I mean, it's exactly the same thing, actually. I mean, my attitude to art is I don't really understand a great deal about it, but I want to listen and I respect and I know there's a language I need to learn. But your attitude to practical politics is an attitude of utter contempt. I mean, it's quite amazing, really. It's, oh, my gosh! You know, and actually, to be honest, you know, what actually, you know, you have to be a little bit more, you have to distinguish between, you have to be more pluralistic. There will always be politicians who have to win elections and deal with practical issues. And in many ways, we talk about the decline of the public sphere. You know, actually, if you go to many of the towns and cities of Britain, they're much nicer places to walk around than they were 10, 15 years ago. I think that the British left has been in the doldrums for quite some time because it's been stuck in a sort of decaying labourism. And it's not really, you know, it's not really, you know, I think that there's a long shadow of Bennism, to be honest. What the RSA advocates is the notion of personal carbon trading, which is the idea that ultimately we would all have, every citizen would have the same carbon allowance.
I find it just really depressing, actually, because it sounds to me that one of the things that you're saying is now everybody must make art about climate change, and anybody that doesn't, it sounds like a completely new Labour thing, and saying that the left has been stuck in the doldrums for however long it is. Well, we've had bloody Labour for the last 15 years. I mean, that's the doldrum that we've been in, is this sort of blanket...
Right. OK, let's have this argument. If climate change science is correct, if it's correct, yeah, okay? If it's correct, then we won't be here, right? Okay? Now,
let's not talk about anything else.
Did I say we shouldn't talk about anything else? No. What I said was, it seems to me to be a legitimate debate about whether or not this is the type of emergency where it is legitimate to say to people, there is something here for us to talk about and us to think about the fact that we need to reflect this in our work. And as I said, it's not a debate, actually, I think that I can have. I think it's a debate that the community needs to have. And I think it is a legitimate debate to have, to be quite honest. And I think there have been other times, and there are other issues where we could have had a similar discussion in relation to, you know, fighting fascism, for example. That was a moment when there was a sense that artists faced a particular moral dilemma, which was impossible. The point is, there are certain issues where it's hard to opt out.
Civilians who are killed as a result of the war? Why can't we talk about that?
We are talking about it. I'm not saying you can't talk about it.
I don't think we are, actually, because climate change is much safer. I'm not saying it's not important, but it is something we can all agree on. Oh, dear, it's terrible. Now let's all go and make art about it.
I'm James Pinar, I'm a politician. I mean, I think it's one conclusion is that artists and politicians from tonight is that artists and politicians annoy each other. And that's a good thing. You know, it'd be a worrying thing if we didn't annoy each other. And I think it's worth asking why we annoy each other. And I mean, one way in which politicians annoy artists a lot, I think, is through instrumentalism, the point Anthony was kind of slightly getting allergic to at the beginning. You know, whether it's in the 80s, you know, art is important because of business or art is important because of access. You know, there is a difficult dialogue about instrumentalism, and I think actually sometimes the arts fall into that trap of wanting to justify themselves because of, you know, you can add anything you want to, tourism, social inclusion, education, whatever. And actually I think a good starting point for the discussion is to say art matters in itself, it doesn't need any instrumental justification, it is part of the truth that we tell each other, it is part of exploring our meanings and understanding, you know, what we are, what we are as a society. And if it did nothing else than that, it would still be incredibly valuable. And all the instrumental stuff is kind of nice to have, but you know, I think you start from the recognition that it matters just because of that truth. But I think it's worth understanding that we are after different types of truth. And I know that can sound slightly risible, but you know, when you were talking in the beginning about art being about truth, politics is about truth as well. It's just the truth is contested. In fact, we're after a very similar thing. Many artists want to change the world, even if it's any, you know, Tom Addy's talking to a very select audience of classical music lovers. It's still about wanting to change the world in some way, and politicians want to change the world. And we also want to articulate our truth. It's just that the truth is different. You know, the truth of an artist, to a certain extent, is one where you can privilege the deed over the relationship. You know, you can focus incredibly on what that precise truth for you is, whereas the politician has to privilege the relationship, whether it's with his own, her own party colleagues or with the public. And in fact, it's ingrained in our constitution. I mean, it's not just the Milbank on message thing. It is the doctrine of collective responsibility, which is something about unique about the British constitution, which means that I, as a government minister, I speak the truth for my party. I don't speak my particular truth as I might see it. I speak it for my party. And therefore, we deal, in some ways, those truths really bang up against each other. We're talking a collective truth for a movement, and we're also trying to articulate a truth for a country in some ways. You know, you're trying to, the best politicians can articulate the truth that the country is talking to itself about at any particular moment. And therefore, it's not surprising that those truths should bang up against each other. And I might say that the truth which Michael Moore says, for example, in Fahrenheit 9/11, where the only picture of Iraq before the invasion is happy children playing on slides, you know, that is not a truth that I recognise, but it might well be a truth that he recognises. And, you know, truth is contestable. Art is part of finding that truth, politics is part of finding that truth, and it's not surprising that we annoy each other about it. And I think it's also, we're both, maybe, there's a sort of slight raging about the power of celebrity now, that actually what has been the most powerful thing in terms of social movement, you know, whether it's Make Poverty History, whether it's the new environmental concepts which are coming up, in some ways both art and politics have been trumped by celebrity, and coping with the power of celebrity in our society and how that can be harnessed, but also the consequences that it has, I think is something that's been slightly missing from this discussion.
Very good. Anybody else want to comment? Right. I don't know if Penny wants to say anything. It's that bad, is it, Penny? Oh, I'm very sorry. Matthew, do you want to say anything? It's body language, isn't it?
Well, I agree. I agree absolutely with what James said, and I think that that sort of pluralism is what we need actually in this debate. And I only apologise if I've created the impression that I think that all artists should be sort of forced to produce sort of socialist realist pictures of melting icebergs, and I'm not arguing that at all. I think the point I'm trying to make is this: no artist should be forced to do anything. But you know, presumably, others will tell me. But presumably, if an artist had worked throughout apartheid, then it would have been a legitimate question to say to that artist: did in any way working in an apartheid society, was that something which you felt you should reflect, or did that influence you, or whatever? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask, whilst at the same time, it's not legitimate to say that because you're an artist under apartheid, you have to dedicate all your work to fighting apartheid. And I think that climate change, for me, throws up a similar question, which is it a legitimate question to say to people, to say to artists, how does your work, does your work reflect the fact that we may be facing this global emergency or not? So it's not an illiberal argument that artists must be doing something. It's a question about whether or not we should enter into this discussion between arts and politics. This question, whether it's an interesting question for us to have,
Ashara, do you want to make a few comments? And then, Anthony, do you want to wrap up? Unless you've had second thoughts, Penny.
I share the point about artistic freedom, and I hope I made it very clear that I was completely opposed to the idea of any notion of instrumentalising the arts, and my colleague over there from the Paul Hamlin Foundation would be horrified if I did anything otherwise.
Anthony?
I think I'm having a terrible, terrible case of deja vu. I was at this conference at the Royal Academy called by Anne Summers Cox, the editor of the art newspaper, with a debate proposition on somewhat these lines. In a time of political conflict, does not the artist have a moral duty to respond the injustices of the moment, or something. The fact is that an artist's responsibility is simply to take, in a way, the imperative of the last work that they've made and build that into the next work that they make. Now, if that sounds like a kind of navel-gazing activity, it's very important that you understand that it isn't. That in answer to Matthew's issue about apartheid, there's a wonderful artist called William Catridge, who has worked in South Africa throughout the entire period of both Mandela's imprisonment and further release. He has made it his life's work, the main complaint, a sequence of extraordinary works that in no way is in a way illustrative of social injustice, but is full with musical accompaniment using Palestrina and Monteverdi. He gives a human evocation of, in a way, both the inevitabilities of global capital, the injustices of living in a township, the sense of disappearance of, in a way, the conscience of the community. But the point I'm making is that I think that we all, the background to, in a way, the material that each of us works with in our work is a world in which I think climate change and an understanding that the human population is greedy and rising and that we live on a limited planetary resource is there for all of us, and I think it is in the work. And if in the material of the work, but also in the work, it's the thing that we, you know, it's the medium. In a way, it's the background medium that we have to transform and, in some way, make again, share again. And I don't think there can be any prescription. I think an artist has to fight jealously to keep his or her freedom of expression. And in a way, the only moral responsibility they have is to make their work.
Well, there we have it. We very much hope you'll blog in the course of the next few days, explore some of the ideas that you may have raised in the course of this evening. There'll be some various people hoping to identify you and encourage you to blog, but some of the comments this evening I think have been so interesting that I very much hope they will also end up on the Guardian's website. So there's a flyer on your chairs for you to pick up and take off with you. And many, many thanks to my panel. I think it's been a difficult discussion. I'm not sure Penny... Well, I think so, but I don't think Penny does. I think Penny may have decided that that it was a step too far. But many, many thanks for all of your contributions. And I think the panel deserves a big clap.